welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Naturalist, artist, and writer Julie Zicafus in May 2017 took on the role of savior to a sick and orphaned baby blue jay. In her new memoir, Zicafus recalls the process of saving and then releasing the jay, and also how the jay she named Jemima saved her back. The title of the book is Saving Jemima, Life and Love with a Hard Luck Jay. Welcome back, Julie Zicafus.
It's so great to be with you, Anne.
The book is on so many levels, beautiful, wonderful, fantastic. I mean, there's all of your beautiful paintings. Julie Zicafus is a fabulous watercolorist. And also the photographs of Jemima. My favorites are after she gets done taking baths. And it's the cutest thing I've ever seen. You wrote that it all started with an egg. That is an egg you found a year before Jemima came on the scene. What happened?
Well, I found this egg in the grass, and I was seized with a desire to try to hatch it, which is just dumb.
I was surprised.
I haven't even tried that.
Yeah.
But I have the permits to do it, you know, so I could technically do it. And the egg came out of an abandoned nest. A chipmunk had raided it and didn't eat this egg yet. So, you know, there was no chance that the mother was going to come back. So I incubated it for a while, and then I accidentally let the incubator run dry, and the egg died. And I was surprised at the force of my grief at this event, and I realized that I had a lot invested in trying to raise a blue jay. So when exactly a year to the day later, someone Facebook messaged me a picture of a dying baby blue jay, I said, bring it here. So that was how it all started, was with this egg that didn't actually ever hatch.
But you weren't necessarily planning on keeping that baby blue jay. What were the metrics of deciding to keep Jemima at that time?
Metrics. I love it. actually, I had been planning to fob her off on the Ohio Wildlife Center, my favorite wildlife rehab organization in Ohio. They do wonderful work out of Reynoldsburg,
right
outside Columbus. And I had thought, you know, I don't have time to raise a blue jay. I gotta send this up there. And I took that bird in my hand. I looked into her eyes. There was somebody looking back, and I was done. I had to do it.
You wrote that raising a jay is different from raising other songbirds, and I'm wondering how so.
It's different because there's a lot more cranium going on with a jay. I'm not saying that other birds are dumb, far from it, but jays are just frighteningly intelligent. They have a sense of humor. They have a deviousness. They have the ability to deceive. They are very, very social. They're very funny. They're confiding. So all of those things that come out more strongly in jays. And, you know, I don't want to malign other birds because I found out that chimney swifts have a sense of humor, too, so which would surprise a lot of people, but they do. I had a chimney swift that I raised, too. I named Amelia. I was raising 7 at the time, and Amelia liked to land on my upper lip, which really, really hurts. And I swear that bird enjoyed watching the tears roll down my cheeks as she clung to my lip with her needle-sharp claws.
I thought you were crying so hard. You were crying. You're laughing so hard. You were crying. But
it was that, too. I was just laughing.
So many, you know, what separates... Why'd you write a book about Jemima?
As I get older, I listen to my little voice, and I listen to it more and more. And my little voice was shouting at me when I got this bird, there's a book in this bird, start journaling, keep a journal. And so I did. And to be fair, I keep a journal about a lot of things, but this I knew was going to be a life changer. I knew it was going to be a game changer to have a corvid in the house. So I started writing as soon as I got her.
A corvid. Tell us that, what that is.
Corvid. The corvidae are the family that includes crows, ravens, magpies, and jays. So really, you can think of Jemima as a small blue raven. That's how smart she was.
I never knew until I read your book about that jays were related to crows and ravens.
Yeah, lots of people don't. They're fooled by the color, and mm-hmm. so you don't necessarily associate them. But they have all the corvid stuff in place, the sociality, the intelligence, the adaptability, the omnivory. They eat anything, and they find ways to find food that would amaze you. Yeah, they're very, very clever.
And that makes it so later on in the book, as you explain, they have a little bit more options when it comes to whether to migrate or not.
Yeah, they do, and they're very individualistic about that. It's they're very much the frustration of ornithologists, because we don't really know why they migrate the way they do, and why an individual bird might migrate in one year and then stay put in the next. They simply don't behave like other birds.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and my guest, Julie Zicafus. If you're a regular listener to the show, you know she speaks for herself. She's a naturalist and artist of many books, an author and artist, an illustrator of a new book, Saving Jemima, Life and Love with a Hard Luck Jay. Coming up later in the program, we'd love to have you have questions or comments for Julie Zicafus. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, as an artist, this is something that's really important to you, but I have always find it, since I started to learn more about birds from you and others, since coming on, you know, having this show, in the first chapter, you brought up something that often surprises lay people when it comes to the lives of birds, and it's something you referenced with Jemima, is that, or with Jay, is that there's still a lot of mystery. When I have birding experts on, you know, world renowned, and they say, well, we don't know. It's kind of shocking to people, as you put it, the things we are not meant to know.
Yeah, not given to know. Yes, not given exactly. To know, yeah. And the undreamt. The thing about jays is that they're so intelligent that you can't actually capture them more than once. So if you've once mist-netted a jay, it will never again fly into a mist net. It will see the poles. It will figure out what's going on, you know, that support the nets. It's not going to do it again. So that makes it very difficult to study them through banding, because if you can't recapture a banded bird, you can't tell what the band number is, and you're kind of sunk, mm-hmm. right? So, and color banding doesn't really work with blue jays, because, once again, you can't trap them, you know, to do it. So mm-hmm. they're too smart to be studied. And one example of this is, I'm a pretty observant person. I kind of know what's going on with the birds in my yard. And there was a jay nesting in a Japanese maple right in my front yard by the stairs, and I didn't even know it. And that's because the jay was watching me and only nest building when I wasn't watching, right? So it's that kind of thing. It's very humbling to know the brain power that's going on here.
And another thing, well, you know, when Jemima was just a wee little thing, she kind of, you let her roam pretty free around the house, right?
I did, and you know, it's a messy thing. It's my house is not for everyone, especially not my mother, my sainted mother. But, you know, you do what you have to give them the freedom to do their thing. And I should say that I'm not someone who raises birds in their home normally. Mm-hmm. I have this beautiful nylon tent out in my four-car garage. I open up the garage so it's open to the air and the sun and the bird song. And ideally, I raise my babies in that tent. But when I put Jemima out in the tent, she moped and she wouldn't eat. So she made it very, very clear that she wanted to be with her family, imperfect as we were, large and lumpy and featherless. And she wanted to be with us, and that was that. First off, she moped. But then what happened later, when I would banish her to the tent for pestering our dog too much, she'd go out there, there'd be silence for about 10 minutes, and then she'd start to scream, as if something were attacking and killing her. We'd come out.
The manipulative.
Like, we'd go running out, and as soon as we appeared, she'd go, oh, hi, I'm a little hungry. I'm going to hop down and have a little food now. You know, it's like, well, you were just saying there was danger, you know.
Uh-huh.
So it's really, really interesting stuff.
Your family got very involved with this as well, and I'm sure they're very involved anyway, but there was a lot of transition in your household at the time, coming and going,
right.
This kind of a thing.
Right.
Tell me, you know, and Jemima related to each member of your family a little bit differently.
It's really true. She was very, very fond of both kids. She would spend long, quiet hours with Liam as he was drawing. She would kind of pick through his pens and his little action figures and things. He does anime art. And he was adored Phoebe, too. And he would she would ask Phoebe to play songs on her iPhone. Jemima loved to sing along with these songs. And so she would hop up to Phoebe and peck her phone. And Phoebe would cue up a song, and Jemima's wings would go out and start to quiver, and she'd sing along with it. And, of course, Phoebe said she was a country fan and an Ed Sheeran fan, but we know that that's what Phoebe likes to listen to, so we're not real sure. But she was galvanized by the tune Barcelona with a peppy beat and everything, and when that would play, she would just sing her head off and mount to a high perch and just throw her wings out and really, really act. One of the really fun things about giving talks for this book is that I have a ton of video in the talk, and I get to play video of this bird doing these things.
You talk about that. You not only were taking photographs and sketching and taking notes and keeping a journal, but you're also filming Phoebe. I'm sorry, Jemima. Sorry. That's your fault. You named your daughter a bird name. But Jemima also had a little brush with the movie business. This is so cool.
It was a very, very cool thing. You know, when you're doing these daily Instagram posts that feature an adorable bird, they kind of get passed around a bit. And I got an email from Anne Prum, who is the creator of Coneflower Studios, which is a wildlife cinematography outfit that has one of their major clients is PBS Nature. And Anne turns out to be the wife of a classmate of mine, Rick Prum, who got a MacArthur grant for his work on feathers. And he wrote a beautiful book called The Evolution of Beauty, talking about how natural selection makes birds as beautiful as they are. Fascinating people. Anyway, I get this email from Anne Prum, and she says, hey, I'm doing a special on butterflies, sex, lies, and butterflies for PBS Nature, and I need a villain. I need a bird that will reliably come in and eat caterpillars for the camera. And I said, oh, I have just such a bird. And I said, what's involved? And she said, well, probably ideally we'd have a box with a green screen, and we'd put her in the box and, you know, have the caterpillars on natural-looking branches. And I said, well, that's all very well and good, but she ain't going in no box. I'm letting her go tomorrow, and if she hangs around, I'll let you know. So Anne was like, fine, okay. And sure enough, she hung around like a dirty shirt. So we set about, Anne sent me like 300 painted lady caterpillars with this stuff. I had to feed them. And so I raised these painted lady caterpillars. I was dubious whether she'd eat them, but she loved them. So I trained her to come into certain branches in the yard to eat these things. And it was lots of fun. And I got lots of great video of her doing exactly what she needed to do. Well, wouldn't you know, when Mark Carroll, the cinematographer, showed up on July 9th, Jemima was happy to take the caterpillar, but she'd fly 100 yards away and eat it there.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a problem.
Yeah, you were sending out vibes, Julie.
I was sending out some big vibes, and I was like the worst stage mother that anybody has ever... I'm the person you don't want in the room when your daughter is performing, right? I was in a cold sweat the whole time, so I had to remove myself from the situation to get Jemima to cooperate. But they got their footage, and she's a star. She's on the special.
The evil, the villain star, but a star nonetheless.
Yes.
My guest is Julie Zicafous, naturalist, artist, and author of many books, including her newest. It's titled Saving Jemima, Life and Love with a Hard Luck J. Jemima came to Julie at about the age of 11 days, and Julie saved her life, not once, but twice. We'll talk about that coming up. If you have a question or comment for Julie Zicafous, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Naturalist, artist, and writer Julie Zicafus in May 2017 took on the role of savior to a sick and orphaned baby blue jay. In her new memoir, Zicafus recalls the process of saving and then releasing the jay, and also how the jay she named Jemima saved her back. The title of the book is Saving Jemima, Life and Love with a Hard Luck Jay. And Julie Zicafus, thanks again for joining us today.
Oh, this is always such a hoot to be with you.
I loved, of course, reading about Jemima's relationship with your darling, adorable Boston Terrier, Chet Baker. He was 12 by the time she showed up. And I can't imagine. I just am so impressed with what he put up with.
he was the American gentleman. There's no question about that. But it wasn't an accident that he was very, very kind to Jemima, because when he was a very small puppy, I would take him out with me on my bluebird trail checking the boxes, and I would let him sniff the eggs and the nestlings and the babies, and all the while speaking softly to him and telling him to respect the bird. And he became so... He was so conscientious about that. Now, you wouldn't have wanted to be a chipmunk around this dog, mm-hmm. because he was, had the trigger for a terrier is a small furry running thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the coolest story about Chet was he saw a small brown, apparently furry thing go running in my yard. It came out from under a spruce tree. And he took off after it, as he would after a chipmunk, trying to catch it. And when it spread its wings and flew, he stopped and sat on the spot because it was a rail. It was the only Virginia rail that had ever visited my yard. It was October. The bird was migrating. And as soon as Chet realized that small brown running thing was not a mouse or a chipmunk, he stopped. So he was incredibly tolerant of Jemima. She was very fond of probing in his ears, his nostrils. She would pound on his toenails, and his only response was to pull them tighter under his body. He was just such a dear little dog. So she would sit on his head and preen him, and she absolutely adored him. And he just put up with her. I don't think he adored her back.
He was 12 years old.
He was. He was actually actively on the way out and, breaking my heart every day. And it was so great to have a little blue court jester there, making us all laugh. And actually, I would have to remove her from the room often because she pestered him so much.
It was super cool to read about her instincts with food. She didn't get her first peanut until she was 35 days old, but immediately knew that she needed to do something with it.
Yeah, she flew around for like 10 minutes looking for a place where she could start pounding on it. And it was just so neat to have this innate instinct kick in of her seeing something with a husk around it and knowing she had to go find a sturdy perch to pound on it. And what was amazing to me was how hard it was for her to get these skills of, pounding open nuts and holding things in her toes without banging, like you hammer your fingers when you first mm-hmm. start using a hammer. Exactly that kind of thing. So it was just such a neat thing for me to see her develop those neural connections and that muscle memory that we take so for granted in adult birds.
How concerned, given her nature that she didn't like to be alone and couldn't be in the tent out in the garage for very long, what kind of concerns did you have about not just imprinting, but a possible inability to return to the wild?
Well, I had a deep faith in this bird. I've probably raised more than 20 different species of songbirds over the years, and I had a deep faith that this bird knew she was a jay. I had exposed her to jays from the very beginning. She lived in the kitchen in a little Easter basket before she could fly, and I had her right by an open window where through the screen she could hear the blue jays coming to the railing. She could watch them all day long, and I was putting peanuts out there for them, So I kept her in close contact with blue jays. So I really didn't have any doubt that she would go back to the wild, but certainly I got a lot of second guessing from people who thought I was making a pet of her and was in danger of imprinting. And I think imprinting is a term that gets tossed around a lot without people actually knowing what it means. An imprinted animal will try to find a human being to mate with when they reach sexual maturity. That is a pretty profound thing, brain shift, you know.
Yeah, that's a big leap,
really,
yeah.
That's a big leap. You really, really have to work at it to imprint a blue jay. You have to isolate it from its kind. You have to raise it way past the release age, which is right around day 40. You have to keep it indoors. You have to give it only human contact. And yes, then you can make them think that, you know, they should mate with a human being. I don't know why you'd want to do that. But I was not going to do that to Jemima. I was absolutely, in fact, I have a video that I was looking at not long ago of me literally stuffing her back out a window when she was trying to come back in the house, and me going, nope, 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 you're not coming in, you know, and stuffing her out and closing the window, because I didn't want to have that sort of long, oh, I've got this pet blue jay, you know. That wasn't my goal. My goal was to get her back in the wild.
It is your goal to get her out in the wild, but you are torn always. It's kind of like a good parent, right? You want to launch them, but
yeah. You don't really want to give them the keys, you know? Like, you want to see them go, but you don't. And I'm just now facing that with my son. He's in his sophomore year at West Virginia University, and I just finally cracked and said, you can come get the car. You know, because it's just life off campus is just proving too difficult for him. He's like, he might as well be sitting on top of a flagpole where he's living. So he needs his car. And, you know, it's not without a lump in my throat and some misgivings that I hand him the keys and say, yep, go drive that highway, you know, enjoy. And the roads in Morgantown are scary, but you have to do it. And, yeah, somebody just said to me yesterday, you seem to be pretty good at knowing when to let go. And I really love that, at least whereas, you know, my kids and my rehab birds are concerned. I think it was my sister, actually, who said that.
Well, she would know then. She's been with you, known her as long as you've known anyone. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Julie Zicafus, naturalist, artist, and author of about her new book. It's called Saving Jemima, Life in Love with a Hard Luck Jay. If you have a question or comment for Julie, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. How did you teach Jemima, or how did she learn to fly?
Oh, I love it. I love it. You corrected yourself. Yes. Yeah. No human teaches a bird anything, honestly. Birds come packed with this DNA that absolutely knows how to do things. It's like they say, if you throw a newborn baby into water, it'll swim. Now, nobody ever throws newborn babies into water, but they can, and they do. And birds know how to fly. They instinctively do it. And yes, they have to learn how to turn and bank and all that, but they're wired to do it. So yeah, she just started little flutters, and then we had an exercise that we called Jungle Gym, where she would hop onto Liam's ankle, and then he'd raise, from a seated position, he'd raise his other ankle up, and she'd hop up to that. And then we'd do laddering, where she'd ladder up the, you know, heights until we had her way over our heads. And that was a great way to exercise her. It was a fun game for her, and she really loved to play it.
June 11th, so let's see, you got her on... what day was that now? I'm looking back.
Got her on May 16th, I think.
Yeah, May 16th, 2017. And June 11th, less than a month later, was release day. Now, when I was approaching that, I was kind of squirming reading the book because I got a little nervous. But it releases a project. It's not an event.
Exactly.
It's a step-by-step project. And you wrote that you never had a bird handle its release so wisely. How so?
She was absolutely amazing. And remind me, I want to tell you how that contrasts with another Blue Jay release I did the next summer.
Okay.
Anyway, yeah, what she did was I carried her out of her tent in the garage in my hands, and I gently released her out into this Japanese maple, the same one where the Blue Jay nest had been, where I'd found the egg that started it all. And I said, Jemima, there's going to be this set of dishes here on a little shelf in this tree, and it's going to have all your food and all your water. Everything you need is going to be here. And that bird stayed in and around that tree for 2 days, just under the canopy, safe, gorging herself on the food I was providing, didn't really make any flights out from there. And when she did forage out, you know, venture out, it was to another shrub right by the house where I had another little feeding station set up. And she enlarged her sphere very gradually. It was extraordinary. The next summer, I had the privilege of releasing two jays for the Ohio Wildlife Center. They'd been hand-raised there. And they knew that I had a kind of a boutique rehab thing going on. And they said, would you take these jays and soft release them? That's what I call it when I subsidize them for weeks or even months after I release them. I said, oh, my gosh, I'd be honored to. So I took these jays. And while they were in a tent in my garage, and as I said before, the garage was open so that birds could fly in and out, wild jays visited them every day. And they even flew into the garage and hovered at the sides of the tent, which is a very brave thing for a wild jay to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it was clear that they were establishing some kind of relationship with these young birds. The day I released them, it was incredible. These two juveniles flew up to the top of a bare ash and began to scream, in stark contrast to Jemima's really furtive release.
Mm-hmm.
And the next thing that happened was four jays, wild jays, came winging in, excitedly hopped around them, greeted them, and they took off to the north together. They were spirited away. And I get chills just thinking about it. But I'm told that that is often what happens when you release blue jays, is that they will be spirited off by the resident birds, and they join the flock. I saw those two jays maybe three times in the next 2 weeks. They never needed me again. They never came in for food that I put out for them. They were with their friends.
What do you think the difference was between them and Jemima?
That's a very good question. I've given it a lot of thought, and I think it may be something undreamt. I think she may have known that she needed to stay close.
Because
I think she may have known that she was ill, mm-hmm. and that she needed the medication I was giving her. That sounds crazy, but you got to read the book to understand.
Right. Let's take a call right now. Let's see. David and Hilliard, you're on the air. Hi, David. Hello, David. I can't hear you.
Okay. Can you hear me better
I can hear
now?
You now. Yep.
Okay, good. I had a kind of a fun experience a couple days ago. I had put some hickory nuts out for the squirrels in my backyard, and they would one at a time grab the nut and go up in the tree and start, kind of chipping away at it. And the other morning I went out and I was watching them, and then the blue jays were down below, and they were eating the crumbs as they were falling out of the tree that the squirrel was. It was kind of neat how they were working together almost as a team.
Oh, how neat is that? What a great observation. That's something I haven't witnessed myself. Very cool. I have a beautiful hickory tree that I call the wildlife feeder, and those nuts fall, and they get hammered open, and the deer chew on them, and flickers come down and feed on them, and blue jays. Hickories are amazing.
David, thanks for that call. Appreciate it. Anybody else? 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So Jemima got sick.
Yeah, well, actually, I think she came to me ill.
Okay.
Yeah, probably my avian vet surmised she may have been infected through the eggshell membrane,
mm-hmm.
with Mycoplasma gallisepticum, which is commonly known as house finch disease. And those of us who feed birds, most of us have seen a little house finch or goldfinch huddled on the ground, all puffed up with its eyes swollen shut. And unfortunately, that's a very, very deadly disease that can kill them. And obviously, being blinded is not a good way to go through nature. So it's pretty lethal. And Jemima started exhibiting symptoms soon after her release, and I was faced with treating her for that disease.
The I don't know if they're emails or however you were messaging the someone you were getting counsel from on this in Connecticut. I can't remember his name, but he in a couple of his emails said, "I'm so sorry." I mean, he was trying to prepare you that This is really bad.
Yeah, it's really bad, and it was quite a crisis for me. I had so much invested emotionally and in work in this bird to know that she had this awful thing, and the sort of sword of Damocles that I was faced with was, do I take her back into the house for 3 weeks of antibiotic treatment? I was told, instructed that her only source of water had to have this medication in it. So clearly it was going to be risky to have her outside with rain puddles she could drink from if she had to get this medication. Or do I try to treat her on the wing? And I had been schooling her so hard for release in the wild, and she was doing so well in the wild, that I made the difficult decision to try to treat her on the wing. And to do that, I had to keep her around for another 3 weeks and give her medicated food and water. And by God, I did it.
I was wondering why. I mean, I understand you need to give her the medication, but they said that you could only give her that. How did you know she wasn't drinking water elsewhere?
Well, she was, but I mean, as long as she had a few good swallows of this medicated water every day, I figured she was getting her dosage, and she cleared up so fast. I mean, it was like overnight almost. She began to get better. So it worked. I had to put stevia in her water to cover the bitter taste of the medication. But I reminded myself that a bird that eats acorns is used to bitter. So it wasn't probably as big a problem for her as it was for me.
My guest is Julie Zicafus. She's a naturalist, artist, and author of a new book. It's called Saving Jemima, Life and Love with a Hard Luck Jay. You can talk to Julie Zicafus if you like. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Naturalist, artist, and writer Julie Zicafus in May 2017 took on the role of savior to a sick and orphaned baby blue jay. In her new memoir, Zicafus recalls the process of saving and then releasing the jay that she named Jemima, who, she writes, saved her right back. The title of the book is Saving Jemima, Life and Love with a Hard Luck Jay. Julie Zicafus is with us today. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Julie has a busy schedule of speaking engagements to talk about her book. If you want to check that out, we'll have a link to Julie's website at wosu.org/allsides. So check it out. Find out where you can see Julie in person, live and in person. Jemima, I've learned a lot from you, Julie, over the years, including the idea that all birds don't look alike within a breed. And I know this is something you've probably known since birth, but it was something I learned from you. And that was underscored for you, though, with blue jays. It started with another jay named Peg.
My goodness, yes. Well, first I want to say, Anne, I love your questions. You're such a close reader, and you just, you're just so good at this. Anyway, Peg was the bird who first turned my head and made me realize that I could tell one blue jay from the others. Now, Peg had an obvious problem. She had one leg that dangled. It was useless. It had been broken. And so that was clearly, a big mark, a red flag, but she also had a really interesting looking face. And so I could tell her by the quality of the feathers on her face, by the long brow feathers. She had puffy brow feathers, very long throat feathers, very thin line around her neck. So my little wheels started turning because I could recognize Peg even if I didn't see her bad leg. So years went by, and then here along comes Jemima, and I'm suddenly looking at the birds in my yard very much more closely, and I realize that I can tell Jemima's best friend, Maybelline, just by how much eye makeup he had around his eyes. And I have to credit my daughter Phoebe with that name. Pretty awesome.
Yeah.
And then now I have like probably a dozen to 15 birds that I can recognize their faces as if one is recognizing a friend. And it's not because I'm some kind of magic genie. It's because I have put in the work and photographed each of these birds over and over and over again, studied their pictures, and made a little rogues gallery of jays. And I've basically figured out what little areas of their markings are different from each other. It's like highlights for children, right? What's different? Find the seven things. And it's such an absorbing pursuit, and I will do it for the rest of my life. It's so fun. So the last chapter in the book is actually an invitation to people to pick up this bizarre sport and join me.
Stella in Pataskala, you're on the air with Julie Zickafoos. Hi, Stella.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I moved to Pataskala in March, and where I used to live for 14 years, I had blue jays coming all the time to my, and their babies in, you know, in the spring. And I would put peanuts out on my deck railing, and they would come and pick them up and fly off. And they were very well trained. I could go out and whistle, and somebody would always be watching one of the birds, and he would tell his friends, there's peanuts out. And it was wonderful. Well, I can't get any to come to my place where I live now, even though I'm putting out all the same stuff, peanuts, you know, all sorts of things. But is there something I can do to attract them more?
Well, let me ask you, are you in a new development? Are you away from woods?
I am in the country, and there are woods surrounding, but not close to my house.
Not close. Okay. One thing to know about jays is that they hate flying across open spaces. One of the things that amuses me most about them is when you see a jay crossing a large field, it will be turning its head and looking over its shoulder as it flies. I don't know any other bird that does that, but jays do it. So probably what's going on is there's a bit of a scary distance they have to cross to get to you. So maybe planting some more trees in your yard to form a sort of a ladder to the woods. Is that possible?
Stella?
I'm still here.
Okay. Is it possible to plant more trees around where you want to attract
It is, but those, I do have some trees. They can't be more than 15 feet away. And my neighbors had blue jays also. Hmm. I just miss their funny antics that they always do. They they grab peanuts out of the squirrel's hands. They, you know, they bring their babies and show them how to eat. And I used to have like about 8 of them that would come, and I knew some of them were pairs. And now I couldn't tell them apart like you could, which is awesome. But I could tell them apart because one was able to get 2 peanuts down its throat to fly away, but none of the other ones were.
I love it.
That one.
I have a feeling you're gonna get them in time. I have a feeling that word's gonna travel if you keep putting out peanuts in the shell. And you said your neighbors get them, but you don't?
Yes, my neighbor has had them at hers, but her feeder is directly out of a tree. You know, it's hanging from a tree.
Okay. Well, you might want to imitate her way of doing it and hang your feeders farther out from the house, a nice sturdy platform for them to land on. I mean, you know what jays like, right? So maybe try to imitate what she's doing and then slowly bring them in closer to the house. They're very suspicious birds, as you know.
Oops. Stella in Pataskala, thanks a lot for that call. I appreciate it. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You do write about how Jemima saved you, Julie, and it was a very touching chapter. Kind of took me by surprise. I sort of expected you to talk about that maybe more at the very end, but you kind of said, okay, now it's time to tell you how she saved me.
Yeah, that was I'm usually kind of a first draft writer. It just usually comes out of me the way it's meant to be.
Yeah.
But man, did I have a lot of drafts on chapter 15, who's saving whom. And that's because I was going through so much loss in my life. As you mentioned earlier, my dog was actively dying that summer. And my kids were both, my son was a senior in high school and my daughter was a senior in college. And I could just feel the hourglass sand slipping out when they would no longer be at home and or even able to come home. And also that summer, my husband decided to leave after many, many years of indecision and sort of marital stress. And so it was as if I had lost everything except that bird. And she gave me focus. She got me back to my true calling, which is watching, studying, sharing nature. And she got me writing, and she got me painting again. And I'll always be grateful to her for that.
The book is filled with photographs, but also paintings. How did you decide what to paint?
Oh, such fun. You know, any illustrator kind of sits down with a manuscript and says, oh, there's some great visuals in that. Mm-hmm. And so one thing that I did as I was painting was I wanted to paint each chapter head in the month in which it was it actually happened. So here we are a year later, and I'm painting away, and as fall's coming on, I'm painting backlit birch leaves against dark autumn colors. And it was just such a natural and wonderful way to do it. I just sort of selected the topics based on what was in each chapter, and then I looked for a light regime that would work and evoke that particular month.
Beautiful paintings. You can see more of them on Julie's website. You can check that link out at WOSU.org/allside. You can also get the book. It's a wonderful book. What happened during the fall migration? I think this is so interesting. Just in general, you've released dozens of birds, and they all, you know, when they go at the migration time, it's always been different. What about Jemima?
Well, she kind of hung around, and she was caching a lot of food, which means she was hiding, little caches of seed and corn around the yard. And she gave every indication that she was going to stay for the winter, and of course I was really hoping she would. And then she up and took off on Christmas Eve with her flock, and I didn't see her again. So I honestly don't know what was going on. I mean, a friend asked me, would she be caching all this food if she were planning to migrate? And I said, well, I wouldn't think so, you know. But maybe caching is just an instinctual behavior that they do whether or not they have plans to migrate. Or maybe birds don't have plans. Maybe it's suddenly the urge overtakes them or their group leaves and they leave with them. I just can't answer those questions.
You told a story about another bird that you had to keep in captivity through the migration and how it battered around for a while and then eventually settled down. And tell us about that.
Oh, my gosh. I was sharing a very, very small caretaker's cabin in Connecticut with a captive orchard oriole who'd been grounded by a cat when she was a juvenile. She had a busted shoulder. So, you know, I decided to keep her. She had a decent quality of life in a big cage, and I love to feed her all kinds of different fruits and insects and lasagna and ricotta cheese and stuff like that. She was just a great bird. Had that bird for 17 years. And when September would roll around, she would fly all night. She would batter the sides of her cage and hop, 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 plink, plonk, plink, flutter, plink, plonk, plink, flutter. And, of course, I was one room away, and she kept me up all night, so I had to put her in the bathtub. I had to line the bathtub with soft paper toweling and just release the bird into the bathtub where she would hop all night and not damage herself against the cage bars. So gradually she kind of lost that, but it was really interesting because I'm pretty sure that she fluttered all night for the exact amount of time it would have taken her to get to Central America. And so these things are encoded into birds. They do it whether we understand what they're doing or not.
The last pages of the book look like coloring pages.
Mm-hmm.
What are those? And then it has a dotted line with a little scissors, the universal signal to cut this out. What is going on there?
Well, it's an invitation. What I've done is I've drawn a generic blue jay with dotted lines to indicate where the markings usually go, and I'm inviting people to observe the jays in their yard and color in the birds as they see them, as they recognize their markings. And I don't know if anybody's actually going to do it, but it was inspired by my friend Donna, who asked me, you know, how do I tell the jays apart? I want to do what you do. And so I thought, well, maybe I'll just write a little guide to doing that. And that became chapter 21, which was just way cool. Maybe it was chapter 20. But I had to ask my editor for more time. Yeah, it was
chapter 20, yeah.
Step Into My Parlor, it's uh-huh. called. And I'm trying to get people to get excited about, you know, getting a little bit more into the lives of the jays in their yard. Now, in Ohio, it's kind of strange because, like, right now I have no jays in my yard at all. I hear them calling as they go by and over. But I get the big influx in late November when the weather really starts to turn cold. And then I get birds coming in for the feeders. And I literally cannot wait for winter this year because I get to look at jays.
I get a lot of jays in my yard, and I'm going to use those little drawings. I'm going to try to see if I can figure it out and find distinctions. Chapter 20 is all about just the breeding of jays, the young jay birds, what their ranges are, all the kind of the factoids and how to enjoy
right.
them and that kind of a thing.
Right, but then it goes way off into esoterica land with, you know, my little tips for discerning one individual jay from another, which is like such a bizarre thing to do, but so much fun.
And then there's the epilogue.
Yeah. I usually don't talk much about the epilogue. It's it is what it is, and there are people on this planet, I am told, who sit down and read epilogues first. Now, don't do that.
No, it's not fun.
Don't
I didn't do
that.
It.
No.
So we'll let people discover that for themselves. But there is an epilogue, and everybody should read it.
Right.
As far as you can't wait for jays. I mean, how has this changed? You've always loved jays, haven't you?
I have always loved jays. Yeah. But oh my goodness, when you're a jay's mom, it completely changes your perception. Well, like when I was a chimney swift mother to seven swifts one summer. It completely changed my perception of these birds. They are not just little chittering flying cigars. They are fools. They're individuals. They're zippy, cocky little aerialists and hummingbirds. Who knew that hummingbirds had incredibly different personalities from one to another? I raised four one summer. And let's see, it was Rufus, Buzz, Bela, and Adventure Joe. Yes. And each one had its own personality, and they were amazing. And after I released them, they hung around for a month and a half, kind of like following me around the yard, like, "Hi, Mom."
I always thought hummingbirds would be, or I thought of them as very skittish birds, and a friend of ours gave us a hummingbird feeder, the good kind, with clear liquid, not the red dye stuff. And we had two hummingbirds hanging up. This is up north in the UP, hanging around us all the time. And they would come within a foot of my face. And then they did these aerial acrobatic combat things where they were fighting each other in the air. And I don't know, it's like they were putting on a show.
They are. Hummingbirds are just the coolest. They're like Uber birds. They're tiny, but they sure pack a lot into that tiny.
Right.
And so do jays. I mean, they've got all the smarts of a raven just packed into a smaller package and with beautiful color.
Oh my
what's
gosh.
Not to love?
And we didn't even get into all that because we're running out of time. But Julie Zicafus, what a treasure. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for being you, Anne, and thank you for asking the best questions of anybody.
Julie Zicafus is a naturalist, artist, and author of many books, including a new one. It's titled Saving Jemima, Life and Love with a Hard Luck Jay. And again, we'll put some links in there so you can see where Julie lives online at WOSU.org/allsides. Thanks to the All Sides staff, Mary Lee Williams, our producer, assistant producer, Kyle McKinnon, All Sides interns, Atiyah Toure, Tatiana Woodall, and Bobby Gerberic, with video production by Rich Blue and Amber Blue. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Thanks again for joining us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.